Hello and welcome to the intro to the Culture File Weekly. The Culture File Weekly will be along in a second, but first we'll tarry here for half a minute while I tell you about what to expect once you're done with the tarrying. It's a tradition. On this week's programme, poet and performer Caroline Bergvall scouts the capital of culture, mezzo-soprano Tara Erocht on the right ways to worry about your voice, Terry Hooley on his rock and roll victory lap, and Owen Nolan wondering about the value of remote working. But we end the tarry at a spot overlooking the Cladder. They said it couldn't be done, and from time to time it looked like it might not be. But 2020 has finally arrived, and with it Galway's term as European Capital of Culture, the opening festivities of which are this weekend in the city. We'll have plenty of files from Galway over the months ahead, but our first visit is a scoping one. Last week, poet and performer Caroline Bergvall travelled to Galway to scout locations for her performance Ragadorn, which happens in March. Ragadorn is a daybreak performance in collaboration with the composer Gavin Bryars, which blends music and poetry and languages from Ladino to Gaeilge, along with live vocals and electronics. And crucially, all of this comes together at dawn, outdoors, and facing the rising sun. Bergvall's visit to the city was to find a location for the Galway 2020 version of this much-travelled work. Culturefile tagged along.
It has nice shelter in case there's wind, and also for you to work with. It becomes more feasible.
Yeah, definitely.
But it is not east-facing in any shape or form. I'm Caroline Bergvall. I'm the lead artist of this project, outdoor, this sunrise performance, Ragadorn, that we're performing here as part of Galway 2020. I'm a writer and a performer. So what we're going to do, we are going to be walking around looking for sites where we can actually have as much as possible an east-facing vista for the audience, because they're going to be joining a singer and myself and some electronic sounds that have been gathered from interviews with people that speak minoritarian or older languages. All that put together in a very simple, quite organic sort of sunrise moment, if you like. And so we're looking for where's the sun going to be on the 8th of March 2020. So that's where we are. So we're just outside the museum now, and that looks good, but it's definitely not facing east. We did find that very beautiful spot. Are we going back that way?
Yes.
Okay, because so far it's this one, but especially the other one that we like.
Yeah, I really like
which
that,
is a sort of car park area where it has everything we need. It has the length, it had a bit of protection.
And a beautiful landscape.
Beautiful landscape. It's east-facing. It has all that wonderful rubbish tip as well there, that big thing, so it creates that contrast in that way.
So my name is Liz Kelly, and I'm a cultural producer with Galway 2020 European Capital of Culture. And I encountered Caroline's work at the International Literature Festival in Dublin last year. I was really impressed and immediately thought, this is where she should be, so here we are.
It's a very particular space. We've just come round from kind of the heart of medieval Galway at Spanish Arch and an old medieval building. And then in front of us is a great industrial bit of Galway with a huge tonnage of scrap metal, which they're about to start dumping into that lorry.
And that, you know, is... I find that super interesting anyway. I mean, you know, it's nearly sort of symbolically what happens with language as well, and what happens with politics of language and dominant languages, and you know that could, you know, nearly represent the way it gets recirculated, all thrown out, you know, like we've done with a lot of, and in fact like Irish has, you know. But it is a different side. Why we love it is because of that a little bit, and also it is that idea of east facing. It is not far from a good east vista. It's really open for the audience, and I think for the way we might want to position speakers, it's allowing us to go with the speaker quite far back into the mix so that we can open up the listening space. This is our favorite one so far, and then we have the museum. These are the two that we're looking at.
So in your metaphor, are you the truck that's bringing the old iron, or the crane lifting?
Yeah, I'm nowhere, but I was thinking more about the nature of song. And obviously, you know, noise, sound, you know, we have all that also through Cage, this whole idea of the, you know, the transformation of noise into sort of discernible sound and sound structures. But I was thinking, well, the idea of song, since I'd used that metaphor of, you know, trashed languages, basically, would this be the new lyric, you know? So what's the next destination?
Yeah.
Is that one of the indoor spaces?
It's potentially, if we had a... There's the east-facing pier over here.
Oh, yeah. So that we thought was too exposed.
We
is
did.
That right?
Yeah, I think we did.
Until you're ready.
Should we?
Do you still have outdoor spaces that we're looking at? To me.
To me.
To greet. To meet, to greet. Initially, it's really something very archaic. It's about wanting to bring people together at a slightly unusual, unconventional hour. And I found that the one remaining unconventional hour that has sort of disappeared from social structure in many ways, especially secular ones, is the dawn. And I really wanted to be thinking about, you know, how do you bring people together to be sort of in that light, which has that strong emotional and symbolic pull when you see the light. And then at the same time be thinking, okay, so what does it mean then to be together?
From here, if we imagine after today you have a spot for yourself, what are the next steps?
The next steps are first of all great relief, because it means that we've all worked really well. And therefore we can start, Jeff and Kiva can start really talking together about the equipment that's coming in. I can start concentrating now finally on being an island, you know, and of thinking about the language that's coming in, of the conversation I wish to have, and then preparing, you know. So we go in studio, rehearse the piece. We haven't worked with each other before, so it's about getting that to gel, to work. I need to get my voice on track as well, because I haven't performed in a while. So it really is moving into the artistic quality of it, actually, you know, going back into the work itself rather than its planning and its sighting. So it'll be exciting.
Yeah.
Caroline Bergvall there, sampling Galway. Ragged Dawn is happening on March 8th. Galway 2020 launch events begin this weekend. All the details all year long from galway2020.ie, and follow Culture File for more Galway coverage. How's the throat today? Well, you know, this time of year, lots of it about, which is particularly bad news if you happen to make a living with your voice. But strep is almost the least that singers such as our guest this time, Tara Arakt, have to worry about. There's nodules too, and anxiety and adrenaline, plus all that music to learn on top. To face this challenge head-on, Drogheda's international singing star has built a weekend of workshops, masterclasses, lectures and showcases at which singers can learn to deal with their particular struggles, as Tara Arakt told Culture File's Ornya Gallagher.
Adrenaline is a really wonderful tool, but we have to learn how to use it. We need it to perform, but we also need to learn how to help ourselves calm the adrenaline down then. For example, an over output of adrenaline on a regular basis can cause stress to the voice, which can cause maybe a nodule or a little lump. And then that's something that has to be dealt with. In the same way that for a very long time we didn't speak about mental health, it's very important that in this industry we speak about vocal health as a very open and very normal thing, because it is part of it. The reason we came up with the weekend is that vocal health is something that was really never spoken about openly. And now we're in a new time when, you know, people can reach out, people can be open, and I want to kind of bring that home and say, you know what, this is also something we need to talk about. One of the main things that I have learned is that there's an awful lot more to singing than the actual performance. And that's everything from making sure you have a good technique, making sure you're able to keep yourself healthy and know what that actually means. Not just the voice, but your whole body, to keep your immune system up, to make sure you don't ever get colds. And then a really big thing that I had never considered before I started into the career was, how do you deal with the come down after a show or with an adrenaline rush? I mean, there were weeks where I hadn't slept maybe more than 3 hours because I was still high as a kite. Another great aspect of the weekend is having a very qualified and experienced ENT. So we've invited Dr. Paul Kwok, who is the resident ENT ear, nose and throat specialist to the Metropolitan Opera. And he is the head of laryngeal surgery at NYU. He's going to come and give a speech on the Saturday. He's a man that I have learned a lot from when I've met him on my travels, and somebody that I think people will find incredibly interesting. Even when I was still in secondary school in Dundalk, I had to get my tonsils out, and that was the first time I met an ENT. First time I was shown my throat with the camera, and I was able to see it myself on a television and see what it looked like, and I subsequently had the tonsils out. So I've been very lucky that I've known that for quite some time. One of the things I do is I travel with a picture of my cords at their healthiest and a picture of my cords during a time when I had pneumonia, so really at their worst. It's something that I never spent any time thinking about when I was studying, but it's something that I think about all of the time now. Another really interesting thing that's helped me a huge amount is yoga. A school friend of mine from Dundalk, who's a speech and language therapist, Emma Wallace, she's also a trained yogi instructor. She has developed an anxiety yoga and a yoga for performers. And that's everything from dealing with how to relax the muscles in your neck after traveling and in your shoulders, to also mindfulness then when it comes to performance anxiety or how to come down after a show, which is a big issue.
You bring these kind of practices into your daily life. It's not just associated directly with the performance.
No. And it's really important, again, for stamina and longevity, that you're able to do those things daily rather than just bring them out as your pre-show ritual. Realistically, every rehearsal hour, that's for you. That's for you to learn your music, to feel good about the role, to enjoy what you're doing. A performance is for the public. And the same as your pre-show ritual, you're nearly just preparing to give it away, everything you've learned. So the best thing you can do for yourself is to bring all of these things into your daily routine. And that's everything from a good diet, exercise, good sleep. You know, it's all of these things that we need to speak about, that it's not just the 2 hours before a show or before a fesh or the exam or whatever. We needed to learn how to be able to calm our own anxieties, because stress goes straight to the throat. But I think the more we speak about it and the more we learn about each other, the easier it is to kind of find our path and help other people find their paths, you know? But I think that anxiety, regardless of your career even, I think anxiety can be dealt with, and I think it's something we should speak about because it affects so much the voice.
Tara Arock there, singing and talking to Áine Gallagher, and that Celebrating the Voice event is this weekend in Drogheda in conjunction with Drogheda Classical Music. And you can next catch Tara singing in Dublin along with Peter Whelan and the Irish Baroque Orchestra in The Trials of Tenducci at the National Gallery on Friday, February 7th. A couple of heart attacks, the odd bout of pneumonia, and some late-onset agoraphobia weren't quite enough to get Terry Hooley off the road. But the punk pioneer and founder of Belfast's Good Vibrations record shop and label, now 71, is about to embark on a Goodbye Vibrations tour, which he says will feature his final DJ outings. Tonight the show hits Dublin Sugar Club, ahead of which Culturefile's Louis Scully met with Terry Hooley in Belfast to hear some fight stories and favourite discs.
The story of Good Vibrations continues and continues, and it wouldn't surprise me if someday somebody phones me up and tells me they're going to do Good Vibrations on ice. My name is Terry Hooley. I was the founder of Good Vibrations record shop in Belfast. And later on we set up a record label. I had been very ill and nearly died 5 years ago. I've sort of quietened down. I'm not as mad as what I used to be. I'd spent nearly three months in hospital, and it was around Christmas time, where my birthday was 23rd December, so I missed my birthday, I missed Christmas. So Stuart Bailey, who runs the OES Centre, decided that I should do a New Year's Eve party that year after I was in hospital. And we did it, and it was very successful. We've done it the last 5 years now. People were coming up and these girls were saying to me, our granny used to go and hear you play records in the jazz club in the 60s and said you were a great soul DJ. And all I go, right, your granny's okay. So I'm now getting people's grandchildren to come and see me.
Most people get out of hospital and the last thing they're thinking about is running parties, but you got out of hospital and then yourself and Stuart said, right.
A month after I got out of hospital, I was back in with a stroke. I had a stroke. So I decided to do 20 gigs this year. Instead of going out just like a whimper, I actually want to go to places like Dublin, Drogheda, Dundalk, places where I always got a good crowd. When I went into hospital, a lot of the bands did a concert for me at Christmas, and they raised a lot of money to pay for my funeral, and also I don't have to worry about that. Because I've never been a rich man, I've never been interested in money. I grew up in poverty and I've seen what money's done to other people, and just I'd rather do stuff for love than for money. Okay, we're going to run through some of the tracks that are very, very important to me. I mean, I'm not trying to be smart here. These are tracks that I love. I mean, I could put in a lot of obscure tracks that probably nobody's ever heard of, but these are tracks that I would gladly have played at my wake. There's not one of them I wouldn't, you know, and I love them. I love them all equally. So I do. It's one of my favourite bands ever, and it's the Rolling Stones, and I can't get no satisfaction. And I used to have a Rolling Stones scrapbook with all the Rolling Stones bubble cards, and I lent it to this guy across the road. He said he lent it to another guy who died. So if anybody out there's got my scrapbook, could I have it back, please? My Friday nights as a teenager would have been going into town and meeting my mates, and then we went to the Spanish Rooms on the Falls Road. And we got a gallon of cider between four or five of us for a pound. Then we went round the back entry and we drank it. And then we took it back and got 1 and 6 back on the bottle. And then we went down to see them playing in the Maritime Hotel. And it was just brilliant. It was just magical. I'm from a hand to the ground. And if you got a kiss and a cuddle of a girl, that was brilliant. And you got the 11 o'clock bus home. Mind you, I never really got on with Van Morrison, but that's another story. I used to hang about outside gigs when I was too young to get into bars and hear jazz, which was the music of my youth. And I got to know a lot of the jazz guys, and then they would go off to England. It was no blacks, no Irish, no dogs in those days, so they would be staying in the same areas as Jamaicans and stuff, and they knew that I was into ska music, And when they would come home at Christmas, Lola would bring me these 7-inch singles. To me, they were going, oh, I was given this by such and such, by one of the artists, and I don't really like the music. And to me, they were worth their weight in gold. And one of the records was One Cup of Coffee by the Wailing Wailers, which I played in the jazz club, cleared the floor, and then I wrote to Bob Marley, and 3 months later, I got a reply back. So Bob Marley and I corresponded. And then in the 70s, I met him, and it was just wonderful. He was a great man and one of my all-time heroes. One cup of coffee, then I'll go. I haven't always got on very well with some of my heroes. Some of them were not really as nice people as their publicity might state, but Bob was a wonderful man, and I've been a huge reggae fan since the 60s. My daughter once said to me, Daddy, the Beastie Boys are coming to Belfast, would you take me? And I had no problem. I'd take her to Kylie Minogue and Jason Donovan and things. So it was nice that we were going to a band that we both liked. And then the day of the concert, the Beastie Boys were in the shop. Kick it. And they were in buying records and stuff. And my daughter phoned up to say that she had the flu and she wouldn't be going. And Gloria says, oh, your daddy's just going to go round the Crown Bar for a few drinks with the Beastie Boys. And my daughter says, I was sick before this phone call, I'm sicker now. So I love the Beastie Boys and I love this record because we all got to fight for the right to party, and that's the way I felt. Like during the Troubles, Daddy, what did you do during the Troubles? You gotta fight for your right to party. We thought and I partied a lot because we didn't go out because our bars were being bombed and our friends were being shot on the way home after the bar. So we did a lot of partying in our house. So it is. So I still fight for my right to party.
Terry Hooley there, and the reporter was Louise Scully. You gotta fight for your right to party. And Terry Hooley will be DJing at the Sugar Club Dublin tonight, Friday 31st, after a screening of the film biography of Good Vibrations. All that starts as soon as this show ends, so we better move on. And finally, on this week's Weekly, everything Samuel Taylor Coleridge knew about the drawbacks of working from home in the very latest of Owen Nolan's slightly unreasonable points of view.
The Xanadus and don'ts of remote working. It's estimated that over 200,000 people work remotely in Ireland, or more than the population of Waterford and Galway put together. That doesn't mean that all Waterford and Galway are working from home. Many could be in official shared or co-working spaces, libraries, cafes, or park benches. Some jobs, of course, have historically had scant choice about working from home or not. Farmers, for instance, traditionally do little commuting. And what Patrick Kavanagh called the standing army of 10,000 Irish poets, when not gazing out the windows of banks or classrooms in their day jobs, have probably been versifying in the box room. One poet synonymous with the drawbacks of working from home is Samuel Taylor Coleridge. In 1797, Coleridge was living in a Somerset cottage when he awoke from an opium-induced haze with an entire poem in his head, the remnant of a vivid dream of Chinese Emperor Kublai Khan and the building of Xanadu, his summer palace. The 200,000 people working remotely in Ireland will know just how important it is to transcribe immediately when you wake from this sort of a drug-fueled haze after watching Holmes Under the Hammer. Coleridge was able to get only 54 lines down intact before being interrupted by a person from the nearby town of Porlock who called on business. The caller may or may not have been an insurance salesman. History is a bit vague on the subject. Either way, he stayed quite a while, and when he left, Coleridge, try as he might, could recall no more of the lines from the dream and had to complete the rest without the aid of unprompted recall. While the person from Porlock became infamous as the unwanted intruder who disrupted inspired creativity, fellow poets have not always been kind about Coleridge's woe. with Stevie Smith suggesting that he was actually just stuck, and Robert Graves wishing the person from Porlock had got around a bit more and interrupted some other poets at critical junctures. Work from home today, as the combined population of Waterford and Galway know, and you're more likely to find inspiration punctuated by the person from Porlock calling to read the gas meter or the electric meter. That's a result of a residual 1970s Ireland still running in the background like an earlier operating system, one that assumes there is a housewife at home. Meanwhile, our increasing adoption of online shopping, combined with very small letterboxes, means you may not get further than
where Alf, the sacred river, ran through caverns measureless to man down to a sunless sea.
Before the front door is besieged by postmen and couriers from Porlock and beyond. One of the issues with working remotely was captured well in a recent New Yorker magazine cartoon by David Cypress. A female figure stands at the door of a home office where a man sits at an untidy desk with computer and printer, surrounded by stacks of paper and other trappings of working life. He's looking at her in puzzlement and asking, "I can't remember. Do I work at home or do I live at work?" Still, isn't it very nice of all those businesses to let their staff work remotely? Not really. Most companies, like most teenage boys, only do things because A, they want to do them, or B, they have to do them. Remote working is most often contract working, which can mean that it's the lot of the precarious proletariat, aka the precariat, the driving force behind the gig economy. So commuting isn't a factor, and it can promote a healthier lifestyle, but those benefits are offset by the sword of Damocles hanging over contract workers. It's a double-edged sword, because while there's no commute, fewer meetings, and the illusion of self-determination, there is usually also no healthcare, no pension, no holidays, no mat leave, no pat leave, no childcare, no sick pay, no bonus, no water cooler, no toilet breaks, no union, and no ability to plan 6 months ahead. Xanadu, as described by Marco Polo, was indeed a stately pleasure dome featuring both a marble palace and another vast palace made entirely of cane that may have been the world's first glamping. Kublai Khan went to his cane palace for those few months of the year it became too hot in his other palaces. On the 28th of August each year, as the temperature fell, the whole cane palace was dismantled, packed away like summer chairs. And so the great Khan, after a season of ruling remotely, went back to head office.
The slightly unreasonable point of view of Owen Nolan there, bringing to a close this edition of the Culture File Weekly. We'll be back with more truncated visions at the same time next week. Until then, bye now.